From meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Have you been able to figure out this whole immigration issue? I haven't. I think it's pretty clear when you watch some media coverage, and it's not so clear when you watch other media coverage. I thought I'd bring back Al Garza. He's been on the show before talking about immigration. Al is the Patriots Coalition founder, and I hope that you'll check out his webpage at patriotscoalition.com. Hi, Al. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you a lot, Dana. How are you doing, bud?
I'm doing good. You know, BP Oil took over immigration for a while in the news, and but we still hear a little bit of it. Poor Jan Brewer in Arizona and battling with the Obama administration, and we go back to the talking about the poor border guard or border patrol agents, Campion or Ramos, and it's all nuts. It really is. It just seems so simple, but yet to the federal government in the United States, it's so complicated. Let's talk about that.
Oh, absolutely. Now, they've made it complicated. It's real quite simple. First off, if you were to do four things, and I believe we've discussed this before, it's real simple. It's a formula that doesn't really take an engineer or a rocket scientist to figure out. You seal the borders, enforce immigration laws, hold people that hire illegal aliens accountable for their actions, and then fourth one would be obviously the public services, the welfare and things of this nature. In other words, you demagnetize America. You give it exactly what Mexico is doing for its people. They're not providing anything. What are they doing? They're fleeing Mexico.
Right.
If you do the same thing in return, they will flee the United States. It's quite that simple. But the problem is that we have become the relief valve, if you will, the release valve for people that are uneducated. Most of them are not healthy. They are illiterate. Refuse to assimilate. They're going to come here and they're going to do things that they're used to doing in Mexico. Bottom line is that this is done purposely. This is by any means no accident. That it is a complete, as far as I can see, and I've examined it very carefully, Dana, and I am of Hispanic descent.
Right.
From what I can see, the illegal alien himself would be considered and regarded a silver bullet. What better way to make change in the United States than to form some form of policy? In that case, would be something like a sanctuary city, don't enforce the law because of this or that. There's always a reason you can't do something in the government's eyes. Yet we're in Afghanistan trying to secure borders up there. We're in Iraq. We're always trying to secure somebody else's borders, not ours.
Yeah,
that to me is ludicrous.
Isn't that the truth? Al Garza is here, and his website, patriotscoalition.com, will tell you more. The governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, she comes out with comments and statements like the majority of those that are crossing into her state are drug smugglers, and she's getting attacked by that big time. But really, is she wrong?
Well, not really. It's just how you look at it and how you present it. It may have been the misuse of one word, and that's all. I mean, we do know for a fact that come from the South, we are infested with drugs coming from the South, most of it being from Mexico. So she's right in that sense. I think where she was, where she kind of just went off to the side, and I don't think it was intentional. I think it was just she misspoke in using one word. She used something like, what was it you just said, the most of the people that are coming here?
Yeah, and I'm paraphrasing. I said majority.
It's just that one simple word, the majority. It's not really the majority.
Right.
I would say a lot of them, but certainly not the majority. I mean, others are coming here, and they're doing some are looking for work, but not all of them. So the bottom line is that we shouldn't even be having to discuss this situation. I personally have been involved in this now, this movement, for 7 years.
Right.
There is no reason that I should be involved. And by all means, I've been threatened. I've been called all kinds of names that I'm not a federal officer, and I don't claim to be, that I certainly should not be out there doing what I do. And all I do is simply observe, spot, and report illegal activity. I am not too far from the border. And the problem with that is the fact that if nobody else is doing it, I mean, had we not brought this to the surface as to where we are at today, this country may have already been completely upside down. Not that it's not already, but it would have probably prematurely been upside down completely.
They tie in illegal immigration into health care, obviously a crime with the narcotics, you name it. But what we've seen, Al, is the politics.
Yes.
Not just the Bush or the Obama administration, but let's go back to Bush. Let's go back to Clinton. Let's go back to Reagan. They've all been there. They all want that Hispanic vote, and it seems like they're just afraid to do what they're supposed to do, or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, but I'll tell you where that's coming from. And this is why, by the way, if you look in our website, we do have a special committee. We have several different ways to engage the problem. That meaning simply, and I'll just back up a little bit if it's okay. What we've got is we've got a search and rescue team, actually two, but let's consider one, a search and rescue team. We're very unique, very interesting. The second one would be the scout unit. It consists of two different teams of three people each, and they go out and scout and look for intelligence. They look for evidence. They bring it back, and then we've got the third entity to that group, and that would be the Border Watch, either you can call it a unit or a squad, if you will. It's a committee for them, more or less. And what they do is that if we deem it necessary to do a muster in a certain area or an operation of observing, spotting, and reporting illegal activity, we will do that. But beyond that, we also have a rural volunteer security service,
mm-hmm.
which, again, it's basically the same as observing, spotting, and reporting illegal activity by the border, only in the rural areas by the ranches, out on the roadways. Then we have the Neighborhood Watch Program, the Rural Neighborhood Watch Program. We have the American Speaks Out Committee, which is the one that goes after and challenges La Raza, LULAC, and that's the reason I want to bring that up. And then we've got the traditional horseback people, which is the Rough Riders. It's a committee designed to go out and explore and gather intelligence where, obviously, we cannot mobilize on foot. So we use horseback. So we've got about 12 different committees to attack the problem. But now let's go back to the original question. The problem that we've faced as Americans is the fact that LULAC, La Raza, MECHA, HBLC, the ACLU, et cetera, MAPA, and all these other organizations are actually the ones behind this so-called Latino vote. There is no such thing as, and there shouldn't be, a Latino vote. It's to say, the Italian vote.
Right.
The German vote. Now, if you say that, you become a xenophobic.
Right.
You become a racist. But it's okay for them to say Latino. Well, I'm of Mexican descent. Does that include me? What community exactly is it that they're discussing? So it's a way they've thrown the ball, a political ball, if you will, and used, again, the illegal aliens or illegal immigration as a silver bullet to make change. So they've got these politicians terrified that if they don't, I mean, how many are there? I mean, I am of Mexican descent, which would, if you look at it realistically, I guess I would be part of the Latino community, and I certainly do not condone illegal behavior by any means, and I do not condone the fact that La Raza is out there doing what they're doing because it's anti-American. So that's what they're doing, and this is where the politicians go into panic. Either they go into a panic, or we have been infiltrated, and I presume that I'm correct in the latter. We have been infiltrated by different organizations, different classes of people from other countries that have no intention of assimilating, such as the case with a lot of our senators, a lot of our congresspeople, not to mention La Raza.
Amnesty, L. When you hear that term amnesty, when I hear it, that means free pass.
That's right. That's exactly what that is. I don't care how they tag it. They can call it whatever they want. If they're not going to suffer any consequences for their illegal behavior, it's amnesty. Every day that they're here and they're not punished, or they're not deported, it's amnesty. I don't care what they say. This anchor baby, by the way, the 14th Amendment, has nothing to do with the way they played this thing and made a political football of that. They're making fun of the Constitution. And they're telling us point blank, well, this my child was born here 25 years ago, and I've lived here 30, so I belong here. Now I need amnesty because I'm in the shadows. Well, they're not in those shadows. They're out there hanging up our flag upside down and tearing their flag and promoting their own Mexican Latino community, as they so eloquently put it, waving the Mexican flag all over. They're not in the shadows. Not at all.
Patriots Coalition founder Al Garza is here, and we're talking immigration. Let's narrow down the law here a little bit. The Arizona law, which I've read, and it parodies, it not doesn't parody, that's the wrong word. It is very similar to the federal law.
It is.
And when you look at that, and you look at now the federal government suing Arizona, and it's just such a, you know, I haven't got much hair left, Al, and I know you don't either. But the more I scratch my head over this one, it's amazing I have anything left at all. I just don't understand the Obama administration and their attack against this law.
Well, I do. And I'll tell you why I say I do. It's because I understand what they're doing, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it. And again, going back to the initial concept and the initial statement I made about illegal immigrants, they are the silver bullet. What we've taken a very, very close examination of this SB 1070, and it does in fact mirror Title 8, Section 1324, and Title 8, Section 1325 of the federal code. And they're almost identical. There is nowhere in there. I mean, they're not enforcing laws, period. What they're telling us is that because this this law is so crucial, the federal law, that is, 1324, that it's so heavy and it's so inhumane that they're not going to enforce it. Therefore, it is policy not to enforce that law. That's where they're coming from. The problem with that is that they pick and choose and they cherry pick what laws to enforce and what laws not to enforce. In this case, any immigration law that has anything to do with sending people back and deporting them and getting rid of them, they don't belong here. They've broken the law. There is a system designed for immigration. Mm-hmm. And we are the most compassionate nation in compared to other nations all combined. We allow more people into the country. Now you compound the problem by allowing voters to completely be unabated, unchallenged, and allowing these people to come in, and they're here. As soon as they get here, they've got amnesty. And the bottom line with this is the fact that 1324 is very clear. If you're here illegally and you don't have paperwork, you're illegally in our land. Why are we going to give them amnesty? All to begin with, the reason for it is like they back in the 60s and early 1986. They promised them. They promised border security if, in fact, we allowed the amnesty to come in. Well, amnesty took preference. Guess what? No border security. We're in the same position now after seven previous amnesties. And we'll continue doing this unless American citizens, thuspatriotscoalition.com, this is why we exist. We're here to educate the public, to let them know that the federal government has no intentions, none whatsoever. If they did, they would have already enforced the laws, they would have already secured the border. This nonsense of saying it's impossible, it is not impossible. If it's impossible, then I guess we don't fly anybody to the moon, and we certainly do not go and attempt to secure someone else's borders, in this case, Afghanistan's. That's impossible.
Absolutely. Al Garza is here. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That makes total sense. What we see in the media, and I want to get into that a little bit, Al, is we see the governor of Arizona making a statement besides the dopey signs that they put in the desert, saying be careful where you're going, and that's the federal government's way of enforcing the border. We've heard about fences that have holes in them. We've heard about drones, and we've heard about National Guardsmen that go down to the border, but they're sitting in an office at a desk.
Right.
But the bottom line is the poor Border Patrol guys who are outnumbered, underpaid, probably have one of the most dangerous jobs in the United States right now, are the real answer here, and there's just not enough of them, and they're not being looked after right.
I have to agree with you. That's Patriots Coalition. I don't live that far from the border. 7 years ago, when I retired from Southern California, moved here to Arizona, I didn't realize that I'd made a grave mistake. What that means is that I moved here and I didn't realize that I was a part of a corridor where these people were coming through and they had total access to my property and anybody else's. If you dare get in the way, they sue you. I didn't realize that. I had in a couple of episodes where I was forced to call the Border Patrol. I'd never done that before. And, of course, the local sheriff's office, and the first thing they asked me and told me, first off, how do you know they're illegals? I said, well, they're not Boy Scouts. It's a group of about 16 to 17. In this case, it was all males. They were actually being very provocative, they were throwing sexual innuendos at my wife right in front of me in my own property.
Right.
My own property, and daring me and laughing at me and mocking me. And I says, you know, Americans just don't act that way. They, you know, if they're going to be in your property and you invite them out, Generally speaking, they're going to leave. They either apologize or say, well, look, I didn't realize I owned your property. In this case, they had no choice but to know and understand it was my property. My property's fenced. So they jumped the fence. But here's my point. When I call the Border Patrol, that's how the first thing they ask me, how do you know that they're illegals? I said, well, there's 16 or 17 of them. They're carrying bottled water, backpacks. They're sweaty. You can see that they've been traveling for days. And in their way of through their tracks, they've soiled their clothing. It's bottom line. So they've been on the road for a few days. You can tell by they're unshaven, and you could tell they hadn't showered for a while.
Right.
All those signs. Well, and then he says, "Do you carry a gun?" I says, "I always carry a gun." He says, "Well, if I go there, and then of course, if you are pointing that gun in that direction," he said, "you could potentially go to jail." Well, the red flags begin to fly at that point.
Yeah.
And I says, well, I need someone here, and I need someone there. Well, you know, we're understaffed, and blah, blah, blah. I says, cool, I'll call the sheriff. I did the same thing with the sheriff, and, of course, they asked the same questions. How do you know if it's illegals, and how do you know this and that and the other? And I says, look, and then, of course, the gun issue came up again and again. You know, the red flag came up, and if I can get there, and, I see that you're pointing a gun, or you've got it unholstered and provoking these poor, helpless people, you could potentially go to jail. And, you know, that's 7 years ago. Mm. I've been involved in this movement ever since that because I knew something was wrong. I kept hearing the word policy. It's policy not to do this, and it's policy not. I says, wait a minute, what about our laws? Isn't it illegal for them to be in my property? Is it not illegal for them to be in the United States? And, well, it's policy not. I says, whose policy is it?
Yeah.
Well, nobody ever gave me a true answer. So I know that policy came from the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, that came from somewhere. Because they're tied into a corporate America, what better way again to make change than to use the poor illegal immigrant? Because if you dare get in their way, you're a racist. I mean, I've heard them all. I've heard all the stories. None that make any sense. You nope. enforce laws, you secure the borders, you hold people accountable for their actions, and stop hiring these people. And again, if you demagnetize America, they're going to do a U-turn. Exactly what they're doing in Mexico is exactly what you would be doing here.
Yeah,
follow the pattern, follow Mexico's immigration laws, and problem is solved.
That is so true. Al Garza's here, and that political correctness or political incorrectness, whatever you want to call it, just the how you were describing things, you know, Al, that, and of course this has happened to you, some of the media would say that you're racial profiling.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then what I've said is that we are profiling. In what they've done is they've taken the word racial and they've slotted it in there to scare the heck out of people, and they do a very good job. They don't scare me because I know darn well what their intention is. Such is the case with SB 1070. It's racial profiling. How is it racial profiling? I dare anybody, and I don't know if you've seen the website, but you can take a look at my photo there, and you can tell that I'm certainly not a German. I'm not a Scandinavian, and I'm certainly not Irish. Very brown, chocolate-colored, in other words. But I have no fear of the law, unless, of course, I've done something wrong, and then I may fear the law, but at this point in time, I've done nothing wrong. I've got no misdemeanors, no infractions, no injunctions against me, no nothing, no felonies, nothing. I go out, and if I'm speeding, I'm going to query the officer and ask him why he pulled me over. Yeah. He's going to make it very clear to me that he pulled me over because I was going 95 on a 35-mile zone.
Right.
At that point in time, he's going to ask me several other questions. One will be, may I see your driver's license, which is customary. The other will be registration and, of course, my insurance. Now, if I supply all those, needless to say, and more than likely what will happen is he will be kind enough to put his signature on what we consider to be a citation. Now I suffer the consequences, and it's going to be in some court, or I just pay the fine. But backing up a little bit, what if I couldn't speak any Spanish, or I'm sorry, English? I'm all sweaty, and I've got five or six other people with me, and I can supply no ID, much less a driver's license, no auto registration, and no insurance. I speak no English, and the guy says, you know why I stopped you? You no hablo inglés. The flag goes up. That's what they're talking about.
Yep.
It didn't stop me. He didn't stop me. I've never been, by the way, and I've never been stopped because I was brown.
Yeah.
I was stopped because I broke a law. I did some infraction. Something went wrong, and I got pulled over, but I've never feared the law. You know, if I went out and robbed a bank and I got caught, supposedly, I mean, you know, I'm a human, I'm probably going to panic a little bit, but that's after committing a crime.
Al Garza's here, and that's so true. Let's talk about the media. And I started the interview by saying that you'll see some coverage, and then you'll see other coverage, and then you really don't know. You know, I call them Joe and Mary six-pack, Al. The people in their living room are watching one channel on the left, they're watching one channel on the right, and they're getting total different perspectives of what's going on in Arizona, immigration-wise, and they seem to forget there are two borders to the United States. There's a Canadian and a Mexican border, although the focus is on the Mexican border. Let's talk about the media. You see Geraldo Rivera with a perspective. You see MSNBC with another perspective, and then you see Bill O'Reilly with a third total perspective. What can the media do to try and get it right?
Well, first of all, they've got to understand what the truth is and what the reality of the matter is. They don't understand either one, and if they do, they're not broadcasting it. Here's what this means. First off, again, I am of Hispanic origin. Now, I'm not going to claim that I love Mexico. I do not. I love America. I'm American first. But I'm certainly of Hispanic origin, or in my case, Mexican origin. But more than that, the bottom line is that we do know for a fact that the borders are not secured. They're just not secured. This could be, the topic could be about illegal immigration, illegal aliens, or it could be about, as I always call it, the three things, the three priorities. They're rule of law, public safety, and national security. All three of those make a lot of sense. Now, in the times that I've been in the 7 years, and it's been quite a while, it's almost a 24-hour job every day for seven years, long years, and very expensive, by the way, out of my pocket. I've been doing this. In that period of time, we've saved over 350-some lives. I lost count after 345. We've saved at least 345, and maybe 350, maybe even more than that. We've done more than that still. We've given out of our pocket, over at least 20,000 gallons of water, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
We've given out food, shelter, and in some cases, rendered medical assistance. We have never, ever, ever been arrested. We have been accused of a lot of things. We've been provoked into doing a lot of things and actually trying to be lured into bad situations. But for 7 years, we've hung in there, and all we've done is brought the awareness that should have been brought a long time ago without blemish. So we stand without blemish. None. Not one time. They can allegate all they want. They can accuse us all they want of any kind of wrongdoing. But that never has happened. That's a very good record. No blemish whatsoever. The law respects us. The sheriff here respects us. The Border Patrol, the ground partners, we got a lot of respect for all of them. But their hands are tied. This is, again, where we come in. We observe, spot, and report illegal activity. We do not accost. We do not arrest. We don't make gestures. We go out and we do what we're supposed to do, and we do it very well. We're an extension of the Border Patrol, so to speak, the eyes and the ears. They need that help. We are determined to help them, and they will. In fact, the ground pounders are very, they welcome us. At one point they did not, they do now. They know our track record, they know what we mean, and we mean what we do.
When we see in the media, and this is my last question for you, Al Garza is here from Patriots Coalition, and check out his webpage at www.patriotscoalition.com. When we see what's going on in Mexico, and I know you've touched on this several times, Al, the drug cartels, the murders, you name it, and then we see in the media the military pointing their guns, the Mexican military pointing their guns at the United States Border Patrol, the FBI getting involved, and you guys are down there as eyes and ears, like you say, and doing what constitutionally is your right to do to protect your country. Just how dangerous is that for you?
It can be very, very perilous, to be quite frank with you. It can be very... what makes it scary is... See, I've been in combat, and I was a PI for many, many years. I always carried a gun. Yeah. I know how to protect myself. That's not the scary part. The scary part is that if you are going to be forced into a bad situation, the first one that's going to be going to jail is going to be you as the American, because they come at you, and they're going to say, well, you didn't belong there. Such is the case with the signs, by the way. They're telling us in the United States that if you go this far in your own country, you know, that such is the case with the Huachuca Mountains, where we're doing all the scouting, and then, of course, the one off of I-8 in Phoenix, the ones that you're probably seeing on the videos.
Yep.
Those are the signs I'm talking about. They're saying, if you go this far, you actually are going to commit a crime, because, see, if you go to that point, still in America, But beyond this point, that you could stand to go to jail because you're going to be breaking the law. Now, the bottom line with this is what got me, again, involved in what I'm doing, is chiefly because, wait a minute, I'm in my country. Shouldn't you, instead of talking to me that way, shouldn't you be talking to the other side and telling them if they come here that we will, in fact, have the Marine Corps out there or the National Guard? Well, they're not going to do that.
No.
They don't want to insult Mexico. Well, I don't care about Mexico. You're insulting me by not enforcing the law. Now I'm the one that's writing you a check on Fridays and telling you, thank you for a fine job, here's your paycheck. Well, no such thing is happening. They're not protecting me. I certainly can't sleep at night. You know, my dogs are always barking, and, you know, my safety, and well, not necessarily mine, my family's. And such is the case when we go to the border, to answer your question. We go to the border, we don't know what's going to happen, because we do know for a fact that our hands are going to be tied. If we wind up by making the right turn instead of a left, and we wind up in a world of hell, it'll be us that go down, not the drug cartels, and certainly not the illegal aliens, because we had no business being there, so to speak, because it's policy.
Yeah, it's something else, I'll tell you.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah, it is a nightmare, that's for sure. Al Garza, who's the founder of the Patriots Coalition. Again, their webpage is patriotscoalition.com. Always a pleasure, my friend. I'll have you on again sometime soon.
Let's do it soon, buddy. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Okay, Al. Take care.
Thanks, man.
Bye-bye.
Take care, Dana.
That's an update on immigration, and we're going to come back with an update on a criminal case about, remember Steve Nodine? That's that kooky city commissioner or whatever he was, committed murder. It's a wild story. Lots of requests to follow up, and we're going to bring on journalist Kevin Lee to talk about Steve Nodine. And a little bit later on, Blink from Blink on Crime will be here. This is the Dana Pritzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. I thought I'd bring on my next guest, journalist Kevin Lee, to talk about Steve Nodine. You remember Steve Nodine as that political figure from Mobile, Alabama. County commissioner, I believe, is what he was. Kevin's articles that he's been writing calls it a Gulf Coast murder saga. It is. There's a lot of intrigue. Murder charges, gun charges, drugs, you name it. Of course, Nodine has pled not guilty. And I thought I would bring on Kevin to talk about Steve Nodine and what's been going on. Hi there, Kevin.
Hey, Ben, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. As you know, I covered this story a little bit here a few weeks ago. Lots of requests to continue covering it. Of course, the alleged murder is that of his mistress, Angel Downs. She was found in her driveway on May 9th. Tell us, my listeners and I, how you got involved in the story, and let's start right from the beginning.
Well, how I got involved in it, I work for an independent newspaper in Mobile called Lagniappe, Lagniappe. We are in Creole territory here, and that's a Creole word that means something extra. And I am the kind of designated murder writer for our paper, so that's how I got involved in this. But Steve Nodine has been known to everybody that covers the political scene in Mobile for about 12 years now. He moved here. He was originally from South Florida and lived there for a while. Moved in the early 90s to Atlanta for a short bit, traveled back to Florida, moved to Birmingham, and then moved to Mobile. When he got here, he started working with various media entities and kind of learned the ropes of the local scene that way. Also started working with various nonprofit organizations and community agencies, and then started working with the local political party. And before you know it, in 2001, he was running for and winning an office as a city councilman here. Then 4 years later, we had a bit of a scandal here with a sitting Mobile County Commissioner that was removed from office under some scandalous circumstances, and Mr. Nodine ran for his seat, won that, and kind of rose to prominence. Being a county commissioner is, you know, fairly powerful position. You control a lot of purse strings for the sheriff and the DA's office. And Steve was also very fond of attention. He had a way of kind of letting his presence be known. And people that went out in Mobile saw him out frequently. He was also one of the first guys in line whenever you would have visiting political dignitaries. I know when President Bush came down here in the wake of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, if you could see any of the stock footage from the archival footage, you would see that Mr. Nodine was always very prominent in the background. So, I mean, he knew the political ropes. He knew how to do what he needed to do to advance his career. What a lot of people didn't know was, while this was going on, he, in addition to being married and having a son, he also evidently had a mistress in neighboring Baldwin County, which Baldwin County has been in the news somewhat recently because Gulf Shores, where a lot of the oil from the BP spill has been washing the shores at the foot of Baldwin County. And Mr. Nodine was going over there and visiting this woman that he befriended in 2005, Angel Downs. And they kind of had an on-again, off-again relationship. Accounts from her friends say that earlier this year she grew tired of his delayed promises to leave his wife and was trying to put a stop to the relationship. There were also accounts from some of her friends that there were altercations between them that could grow very heated, sometimes even violent, as she accused in an email exchange that became public recently. On Mother's Day, they apparently spent, according to some witnesses, a day at the beach in Pensacola, and then that evening she was found dead in her driveway from a single gunshot wound to the head. And he was the sole suspect. He was indicted by a grand jury on May 24th and is presently facing charges not only for the murder, but also for drugs that were discovered in his county-issued vehicle this previous December, on December 23rd. Those charges will be in Mobile County. And then he's also facing federal charges for a federal statute that makes it illegal to possess a firearm while you are addicted to a substance. And that begins, the federal trial begins August 2nd. Jury selection begins then. Any further questions?
Yeah, great journalist. No, I tell you, you covered it, but there's obviously a lot more to talk about. Kevin Lee is here, and we're talking about the Steve Nodine case, the Gulf Coast murder saga. And if you click on the link in the show notes, you can see Kevin's articles and learn more about this case. Yeah, you talked about Nodine, the stock footage with Bush. Loves the cameras, loves to schlock it up and be there, I imagine, a personable kind of guy. Was his political ambition higher than county commissioner? Sure sounded like it to me.
You know, I don't know for a fact because he never said as much to me. My relationship with Mr. Nodine was almost non-existent. I would see him with friends out, and, you know, we had mutual acquaintances. He knew one of my editors much better than he did me. Mr. Nodine was very good about making himself a valuable source to media. He knew that access paid off in the political arena. I've heard various local journalists say that they had heard him talk to them about higher aspirations. There's a gentleman named Eddie Curran, who's a locally notorious investigative reporter, that Mr. Curran had a blog story recently about running into Mr. Nodine a few years back, and Mr. Nodine told him that he had aspirations of running for Congress. And, you know, I would imagine that his aspirations fall in line with most other people that are in politics. Most people that do get into politics have aspirations to higher office.
Yeah. Yeah, and it sounds like this is a classic case, but also someone with a very dark secret that he was keeping. Kevin Lee is here talking about Steve Nodine. How about Angel Downs? We touched very briefly in my last segment that I did on the story about her and her family. What can you tell us about her?
Okay, well, Angel was born into a military family. She was born on a base in Missouri, and her parents... She grew up in Warner Robins, Georgia, which is a town near Macon, Georgia. Middle Georgia is what the locals call that region. And Warner Robins is basically the community that sprang up around an Air Force base of the same name in the post-war boom. She grew up there. When she was a toddler, she was diagnosed with a heart disease, and they had her on a heart and lung transplant list through most of her life, and then they changed her drug therapy in her 30s, and it seemed to tame the condition, and she was taken off the transplant list, got a new lease on life. In 93, she married a gentleman named Chris Downs. They subsequently moved to Baldwin County. Mr. Downs works in sales down here, and at some point after they'd been married about a dozen years, they Angel decided that she had missed out on some portions of life that other people had been able to chase because of her health concerns, and Chris and she reached a rather amicable divorce, which is really strange, but when I talked to Chris after one of the courtroom proceedings, he agreed with the reporters that were speaking to him that that it was unusual, but you could see that there was an actual friendship and still a deep bond between them when he was talking about her. And so they kind of they remained friends, and about the time that they broke up, she started dating Mr. Nodine, according to her friends and family. Now, there was an instance, where was this? This was in 2006, I believe it was, where Ms. Downs had a an overdose of sorts. Some of the officers that attended the incident labeled it a suicide, but her family members and friends disputed that characterization repeatedly and said that it was basically an accidental overdose. It didn't kill her, needless to say, but the gun that she was shot with in her driveway on May 9th was her own gun, a 9mm Glock. That she was shot with, and they did. It was divulged that Mr. Nodine had a 40 caliber that was issued to him by the county, Mobile County. Our previous sheriff felt it necessary to issue a handgun to him and one of the other three county commissioners during his tenure. Mm-hmm. And you know, they ran the ballistics on it. Of course, it's 40 caliber and 9mm are different. So
yeah.
They eliminated that, but it was it certainly opened up a can of worms when they found out that he not only had that, but had basically what was an honorary badge from the Sheriff's Department that he, at times, according to Ms. Downs, she accused him of trying to flash that badge and bluster his way through situations where supposedly there were people that were trying to intervene on her behalf during altercations between them. And the Escambia County DA, which is a county northeast of here, when they were looking into the drug charges that I mentioned before from December of this year,
right.
Stephen Billy, who is the Escambia County DA, told press that he found out that Mr. Nodine, at the time that the truck was brought in for service, when the marijuana and the Lortabs were discovered in there, that Mr. Nodine had a work order in for the truck where he wanted blue police lights installed on it.
Jeez. Yeah, it sounds like... Yeah.
It seemed to fit into the pattern that she was accusing him of at that time. Now, that's completely speculative as to what he used those for, whether it would be used in the advent of a natural disaster or anything, because we are prone to hurricanes down here. Interestingly enough, Mr. Nodine turns 47 years old on Friday. So he's you know, firmly in middle age, a guy that still had a lot of political future in front of him.
Yeah, pretty young, and of course her family, from what I've heard, is a big force behind this investigation. What can you tell us about Angel Downs' family?
I just know that she has a sister, Susan Bloodworth, that has been very involved in this. Ms. Bloodworth has kept her cards close to her chest. She's cooperated greatly with the district attorney in Baldwin County, Judy Newcomb. Ms. Newcomb, interestingly enough, is not likely to be the prosecuting attorney when this case finally makes its way up the docket and comes to trial, because we have an election coming up in November, and Ms. Newcomb's name will not be on that ballot. She lost her primary bid. So that, you know, I don't know how that's going to affect the case, if at all, but it will definitely be interesting to see if they change her tack in any fashion after the new district attorney steps in. But her family, and like I said, Chris Downs has been firmly involved in this as well.
Right.
Every time I've seen the family, Ms. Downs' family, make an appearance, her ex-husband has been there with them the whole way. So even though it's very unusual, they're evidently, I mean, that would lend evidence to the fact that, you know, there was still a bond between them.
Absolutely, because in some cases like this, the ex-husband wants to just stay as far away as he can and not get drawn into it at all. And
they're not a suspect themselves.
Exactly. This whole story, the Stephen O'Dine story, you called yourself the murder writer or the guy who writes for about murders at the start of the interview, and I chuckled at that a little bit. But I think that is important, and one of the questions I want to ask you, when you get a story like this, a lot of intrigue involved, you know, the Gulf Coast right now is just all about BP, but there's other things that are going on. How do you cover a story like this? You know, some people would compare it to, you know, like one of those TV movies on Lifetime or something. There's just so many different angles, and you said in an email to me, quite a cast of characters, and it certainly sounds like there are.
Yes, there is. One gentleman that stands out right off the bat is a fellow that was a friend of Mr. Nodine's, named Mickey Dearman. He appeared as a character witness at a pretrial bond reduction hearing. Mr. Dearman is a car salesman and assistant volunteer fire chief in an outlying suburb of Mobile known as Sims, Alabama. And that's S-E-M-M-E-S. Mr. Dearman, his father founded the volunteer fire department in that unincorporated area, and he said he had been a confidant and a friend of Mr. Nodine's for years. He also is a producer of rap records on the side too, but one of the more notable scenarios that unfolded in the course of covering this was at that aforementioned pretrial hearing. Mr. Dearman was on the stand, and D.A. Newcomb was asking him if he had ever been in trouble with the law himself, and he told her no. And I remember sitting in the gallery, and one of the assistants for the DA, after he gave that answer, got up and shuffled out of the room quickly. Mr. Dearman left the stand, sat back down in the gallery again. Everything proceeded as the judge was talking from the bench at one point. This assistant came back in with a piece of paper and put it on the desk next to DA Newcomb, and they whispered to each other for a moment and were pointing at some things on the paper. Judge gaveled the proceedings to a close, and as soon as he did, Ms. Newcomb jumped up and stepped towards Mr. Dearman, and she pointed at the paper and looked at him, very close to him, and said, "Is this you?" And he looked at it and paused for a second, and then he just said yes. And we asked the DA outside in the hallway afterwards when she was talking to the press what was on there, and she said that some things had come to light. What it was that he had an outstanding warrant himself. Or he had outstanding charges himself for threatening a colleague, another fireman, with a pipe wrench and missing a court date. I don't know if she's going to prosecute him for perjury on that, because he was under oath when he said he had never been in trouble before. But that, in addition to the fact that there were some photos that came to light of him basically hanging out with some of his rap buddies, that, you know, there were some very provocative photos that were connected with that came to light, and Mr. Dearman had offered his house up as a place for Mr. Nodine to stay on house arrest if the bond were made.
Yeah.
And at that point, the judge decided, no, Mr. Nodine's not going to be staying with Mr. Dearman on house arrest. Mr. Nodine, however, is on house arrest at this moment. He made bail. The bond was originally set at $500,000, was subsequently cut in half to $250,000. And they paid that, they required that, 20%, and normally it's 10% of the bond is offered in cash, and they required a 20% cash bond in this instance. And he's staying in a two-story historic, mansion in the Garden District in Mobile. He's on house arrest, has a bracelet and the whole nine, ankle bracelet and the whole nine yards. He's allowed to leave for legal, medical, religious, and employment purposes. Whether he has a job at this point, I don't know. I know he was spotted leaving the house, gassing up the car, telling some passersby that he was going for a job interview at one point. A day or so later, he was spotted darting into a restaurant downtown that was owned by a friend of his, beseeching passersby to, quote-unquote, keep praying for him. But for the most part, I'm pretty sure he's staying around the house because his ankle bracelets are fairly accurate.
Maybe he can get a job with his buddy as a used car salesman.
I don't know about that.
And that's interesting, having a used car salesman and a fireman. When you get hosed, you literally can get hosed by that guy. How's that? Ba-boom. I should have a little drum roll.
With the puns.
Yeah. Listen, we're just about out of time. Kevin Lee here talking about Steve Nodine. Check out the link on the show notes. What's your next story going to be about?
I'm just following this right now. I'm normally, when I'm not writing about murders, I'm normally the arts editor for our paper. So this is, tell me about it.
I love it.
This is my non-arts beat for the time being, and this story is going to go on for a while. We have a federal trial in August. I don't know when the murder trial is going to start. The docket in that county is noted for its backlog, so it could be a year from now.
Well, if Nodine does go to jail, get him a paint-by-number set, and then he can give it to you, and you can write about it.
There you go. Art is rehab.
All right. Thank you, Kevin.
All right. Thanks, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Yeah, I love that. Used car salesman and a fireman together. Boy, will you get hosed by that guy. That's a bad joke. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Blink from Blink on Crime. Okay, we're back. It's no coincidence that the PSA I played just before my next guest is about binge drinking. No, it's not. But I don't know why I said that. I'm just in a weird mood tonight. You'll know Blink from Blink on Crime, our sister blog. She is here to talk about the Kyron Horman case and some interesting news that's come forward about that. Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening. Is there a reason I have to be harassed?
Yeah, I don't know. file a complaint with Red and he can put me on probation or something.
I take it as a compliment.
Well, you know, what probation means, if you're Lindsay Lohan, you go to jail for 90 days and you can write F you and your fingernail. Although I don't have much for fingernails like that. But we're not going to talk about that dopey woman. We're going to talk about an important case, and the Horman case. What is going on?
Well, everything, I guess, is the short answer to your question, Dana.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on this week, and I fear there's going to be much more in the coming days. Kyron Horman, as you know, was a 7-year-old little Portland guy. I like to call him my red tree frog expert, who has literally just captured the hearts of really all of us.
You bet.
He seemingly vanished out of his Skyline school. He's in the second grade there at a science fair. Sadly, what has developed in the last few weeks appears that his stepmother, Terry Horman, may have a level of culpability in his disappearance,
mm-hmm.
as well as as yet unnamed landscaper that she allegedly hired November of last year. In this past, it wasn't this past week, on June 26th, when Terry Horman was scheduled for her second polygraph. During that time, apparently they were also speaking to this witness, we'll call him the landscaper for obvious reasons, and apparently she admitted to her relationship with the gentleman but did not admit to what he claims, which is that she hired him for a murder plot against her husband, Kane.
Mm-hmm.
And right after that, actually simultaneous to that, the Multnomah County Police Department had informed Kane of the allegation, and he took the couple's 18-month-old daughter, Kiara, out of the home, moved out, if you will, while this was going on. She had returned home, and apparently there was an undercover sting with a detective from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, where this gentleman, in a very similar white truck, that police were alleging may have been at the scene of the school, pulled in front of the house and demanded a payment of $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly, it was for a down payment, or obviously not a final payment, because Mr. Horman is still obviously alive, but relative to whatever plot they're alleging that they had hatched together. What ensued was that Terry Horman called 911 and expressed that she felt threatened by this individual. The word extortion was used. We do know his ID because over a police scanner, and I'm sure this will thrill you as a law enforcement officer, it was open.
Yep.
So his plate and his ID and registration was run through the system through an open channel, so it is known, but media has elected not to release his information. Now, with this situation came a divorce filing and a restraining order filed by Kane Horman literally on the 28th, and it was sealed immediately, which, as you know and I know, an ex parte order of sole custody is almost impossible
right.
to get
yeah.
unless there is an immediate physical threat. It's my understanding from sources that the 911 call was used in order to receive the restraining order, and that will be released tomorrow. There was attempts to unseal it that were successful. Let me say it a different way. It was successful, but the district attorney has not objected to its release
mm-hmm.
either, which it obviously wasn't their original position. So we can expect to see that tomorrow. Dana, I think this is just going to be as bad as we think.
Yeah. Well, and I can remember very early on in this story. In fact, I think I had you on that night. We were and Clint Van Zandt, and we were talking through the show about this case, and then you see the video of the stepmom and the I'm not much of a body language, a facial expression sort of guy, but by
sure.
God, when you saw that video, you knew right away that she's as dirty as your grandpa's underwear, and I don't even know what that means, but there was something wrong. Her story, dropping the kid off, and all of the stuff. Now, we're hearing that there's been two polygraphs, and in my line of work, when there's two, usually that means that the first one was inconclusive or they failed it, and they're mm-hmm. trying it again at their request. What can you tell us about her and the polygraph?
I can tell you that there were areas where she was deceptive. They're not quoting that. Dan Staten, who is the Multnomah County Sheriff and my new man crush, will not specify that, but I can tell you from inside sources that she was deceptive, because that's the terminology that we use, and she was deceptive on questions that were relative to lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So what we know is she was not told that she failed the first one, but she was told that she was evasive. They didn't feel that her answers were complete. Now, as a private civilian without counsel, I will say that she did agree to do a second polygraph. My sources tell me that she stopped when they brought up the landscaper and that relationship. She ended the interview in an effort to invoke counsel.
Yeah.
And that was that.
And you're right. There's more is going to come of this week. We're going to hear more. There's things that are happening. The law enforcement is playing it close to the vest, as they like to say. And the media, and I always like to bring this up, especially with guests like you, because the blogosphere reports things a little bit differently, well, actually a lot differently, than the mainstream media does. And sometimes we're accused of things that really aren't fair, but really, when it comes to it, Blink, the mainstream media has been looking at us here lately to pick up some sources for their stories.
They have, and I've been in contact with the two major hubs that are there, which are KTU and KOIN, and they're fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, these are people that did it right. They called, you know, they emailed me and said, "Hey, we'd like to feature some of your exclusive work," how are you open to less linking and things like that? And that is really the way that it's done.
Yep.
And I have to say, in speaking with them and understanding the way they're delivering news to their people, you know, they're boots on the ground as opposed to us being a national site. Even though I've got contacts, they're still, you know, they've got the, you know, the smell, the touch, the taste of the community.
They're there.
And it's really, it's somber. You know, it's that feeling that everybody knows what's coming. It's going to be horrible. And they just really want it to be done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whatever it is, you know, we'll deal with it. But it is time for it to go on. And honestly, Dana, I expect an arrest in this case, if not tomorrow, by the end of the week. And I don't know if it's going to be Ms. Horman or if it's going to be the gentleman landscaper. But what I do know is if you make an allegation that somebody's in a murder-for-hire plot and you acquire, which a lot of people don't realize, you acquire a subpoena to be able to conduct a sting and have that take place in front of someone's home, which inadvertently ends up in a 911 call, that individual had to be told she was a suspect at that time.
Yep.
In accordance with Miranda.
Yep.
Correct?
Correct.
So what I do know is they've now got a witness that they believe that she solicited to have her husband killed under contract. So if you have that information, you can't not arrest someone. Right?
Right.
You can't seek a restraining order, in this case an ex parte, immediate restraining order that gets sealed. So my point in telling you that is somebody's going to get arrested. You can't make those kinds of allegations in open court and then, of course, close court and then have there not be an arrest of some time. Will it be specifically for Kyron's disappearance?
Yeah.
I can't say.
We don't
it may
know.
Take,
yeah.
you know, an arrest on different charges. But what I can say about this particular jurisdiction's legal system is that they have three different sitting grand juries throughout the year in Multnomah County. And their ADAs, or assistant district attorneys, use them almost in place of preliminary hearings. So there are three. There is one specified for what we'll call, you know, violence against the person or, you know, those types of crimes. And there is one against property or, you know, vandalism, burglary, those types of situations. And then there is a third unit that deals specifically with drugs.
Right.
So they have three sitting grand juries. They have the capability to convene a grand jury, a special grand jury, which we see oftentimes in what we know will be a high-profile case. I'm feeling strongly that they do not have the time to put that together and keep it a secret. So I think this week the sheriff's office is making some hard decisions about how they go about apprehending a suspect.
I agree. And whether it's her, whether it's someone else involved, the gardener or landscaper or whatever you want to call it, who knows? What we all want is we want that little boy to be found alive and well. We don't know what's going to happen. There have been miracle cases, but really, Blink, when you put all the pieces of this puzzle together and they're starting to form up, it's just, I don't know.
You're right, Dana. Yeah. And sadly, I don't believe this is going to have a happy ending, and that isn't a, you know, tried and true person that works these cases and just thinks they all end badly. That's based on the fact that, statistically speaking, and from somewhat of an insider perspective, it just simply does not look good for this little guy. A picture of his glasses came out, I think, about 2 weeks into the investigation, and our experts took a look at him, and we feel pretty strongly that they actually belong to Kyron. And then right after that, a photo was released by the FBI of him without glasses. And certainly one would assume that if you're releasing a pic of the glasses and then subsequent to that a pic of him without glasses, there's a fair chance they know that he's not wearing them.
Yeah. No.
So, sadly, I would just want to say I implore anybody with any information, and we've developed a very strong network. The people in this community love this child.
Right.
and have adopted Kyron and finding him, you know, as their resolution. And I see that a lot, but in this area, I don't know what it is. And I've not been, you know, I'm a Portlandite, if you will, but I just, there's such a sense of community and of ownership of this child that I'm sincerely hopeful that somebody does the right thing for this little guy, and he's found.
Yep, I agree. We all went through that with, you know, Kaylee Anthony, and I can name many, many others that we've talked about on this program over the years. And Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and check out her blog at blinkoncrime.com for more information on Kyron Horman. I want to share a quick email with you before I let you go from Joe Tacopina. Sent me this today. It says, Dana, I'm not doing interviews, but let me state that I am not, and the not is in big bold letters, going to Peru, and I am not working on the case in Peru. How these rumors get started is beyond me, Joe. Joe Tacopina sent me that. And I want to end up with this. When you see this, those types of statements, and I can think of many cases where they have come forward where the lawyers or whoever involved said, I don't know how the media got this. I don't know where this rumor started. I don't know how this started. When we deal with cases like this on the blogs, we may throw out a rumor now and then, but really what you do is you back it up with, like Jack Webb used to say, just the facts.
It is, and in response to Mr. Taco's comments, I actually referenced him probably in a return comment on a different case this week, and it was in respect to what happens when high-profile attorneys take these cases, and I believe this is in the case. Stephen Howes, who is spelled H-O-U-Z-E, is a predominant, very successful defense attorney in Portland. I'm certain that given the current legal battles facing Ms. Horman, she cannot afford this gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see, sources that were on this right away, we're going to see another Casey Anthony situation where a defense or representation, I should say, is going to be funded through imaging rights. That sickens me.
Yep.
And my comment in response to that was, I have a question for Mr. Tacopina, and that is, has he visited Melanie McGuire lately? I doubt it. Has Mark Garagos visited Scott Peterson lately? I doubt it. The well ran dry. They're not so much friends.
That's well said. Well said. And Ms. Horman is innocent until proven guilty, but there are many lawyers out there licking their chops in order to get in front of the camera.
They are, and that's a great point. One of the things that we've covered in this case is I've been very solid in everybody was out to persecute Ms. Horman early on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was people get a what's the word I'm looking for, you know, a smell for how law enforcement is facing or working. They know when a family is not so out in the public, you know, really begging for somebody to help them with their situation. There could be an issue because of the parallel investigation, but I've been I've tried very diligently to say, look, you know, let's not rush to judgment. And for the record, I believe Ms. Horman's lifestyle situation or issues are directly relative to what happened to Kyron. I don't feel she herself harmed this baby.
Right.
So that's my only line of delineation. But frankly, I really don't care. I just want him to be found, and I want him to be recovered so that whatever's going to happen next can at least include a measure of peace for his parents, for Desiree and Tony Young, and for Kane Horman, and the other children that are involved in this situation. There's a lot of them, actually. There's another sibling of Kane's through his biological mother. There is another sibling of, excuse me, Kyron's. There's another sibling of Kyron's through his stepmother. Excuse me, there's two, and then there's some extended family members. But this is a big family. There's a lot of people that are affected by this, whose lives right now are, you know, in a circle of grief.
Yeah.
And he deserves to be found. So I'm really hopeful that people do the right thing, Dana. And I do appreciate you covering this case.
I agree. Thanks, Blink.
Take care, Dana.
We'll talk soon.
You got it. Bye.
Bye-bye. I agree. You know, do we know what happened? No. I kind of agree with Blink. I'm not sure if she had any, you know, her lifestyle may be part of this. Did she herself harm that child? I don't know. I'm not sure of it. We'll find out in the next little while, but I'm sure there are a lot of high-profile lawyers out there that are just willing to, wanting to get involved in this case. And, yeah, innocent until proven guilty, absolutely. Everybody deserves equal representation under the law. That's important, too. But the lawyers and how they handle themselves, especially in the media, it'll be interesting to watch this case. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Our webpage is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. There you can hear the show live. You can pick up podcasts of past shows, hear the daily commentary, leave comments, whatever you like. I hope you will join us again here real soon on the Dana Pretzer Show. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.